It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bicker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest lays out a plan to turn the tide on suicides among U.S. military veterans.
First, we're talking about the top news of the day, the passage of right-to-work legislation in Wisconsin.
This morning, the Wisconsin State Assembly passed right-to-work legislation after 24 hours of debate. The bill bans labor contracts requiring workers to pay union fees. The measure was moved quickly through the state legislature in an extraordinary session. Governor Walker is expected to sign it as early as Monday.
Jeff Vash is with the union that will be affected. He's the president of the local UAW 180 in Racine. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica, for this opportunity to talk.
When you first heard that Republican lawmakers were considering right-to-work legislation here in Wisconsin, what went through your mind?
I was concerned. I was extremely concerned for not only unions, but all of the citizens of Wisconsin.
And did you imagine that the bill would move quickly? It was fast-tracked through the legislature. Republicans had the vote, so they wanted to move it forward. What was your take on how quickly right-to-work legislation moved?
Well, I don't think that any legislation of this degree should be moved through the process that quickly. This is a game changer for our state. So people deserve the right to be heard. I mean, when it went through the Senate, there were many people that had signed up to be heard, to speak on the issue, that never even got the opportunity. So anytime you take that right away from the people, this is a wrong process.
Are you surprised that this bill passed in the state's legislature and looks to be signed on Monday by Governor Walker?
No, I'm not surprised at all. In fact, right after the elections, when we have a majority of Republican representatives in all of the houses and the executive branch, I had anticipated this would happen sooner or later. I did not anticipate it happening this soon, although I knew it was going to happen sometime this year.
Did you take part in any protests or do anything to try to stop the progress of the bill?
Actually, I did. I was up in Madison 3 times last week. I have a daughter up there, so I'm concerned about all of it. I'm concerned not only about right to work, but I'm concerned about the budget. And there was a lot of talk about this right to work debate masking some of the things that were happening in the budget. So I was concerned about all of that. So, yes, I did go up there a few times last week.
I want to go back to 4 years ago when Act 10 passed and changed things drastically for public sector unions. Did you think at the time that something similar could happen with private sector unions?
I think it was at that point when I knew that something could happen with public sector unions. I think it was just the natural progression. That's why we worked hard. We worked hard during the elections to try and get politicians in place that understand what this means to our state, our community, our workers. And I was disappointed with the results of the election, but that's what happens when people get complacent, and I hated to see that, but that's the way that went down.
Did you participate in any of those protests with public sector unions against Act 10 when that debate happened in Wisconsin? You said you were in Madison last week. Were you there 4 years ago?
Absolutely. I went up there a dozen times. Like I say, I have a daughter at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So I'm very familiar with Madison. I go up there often. And I'm just concerned. I was very concerned with that. I knew the downward spiral would start then, and it did. So, yes, I was involved, heavily involved in that. I bet you I went up there a dozen times during Act 10.
Did the protests feel similar to you from Act 10 and also again before right-to-work legislation was passed?
It was very similar. It all has to do with taking workers' rights away from them, right? The opportunity for them to sit down with the people, whether it be a company or a board, an education board, and express what they feel is the best thing, not only for the workers, the teachers in that aspect, or the public servants. We had an opportunity to try and look at what was important. and not only for those people, but for our communities. For example, a teacher, if they have to deal with things within their classroom and they need help from the board, what is the better way, the best way to approach that? It's go to the board, see if you can discuss this, and within a collective bargaining agreement where nobody can actually back away from a commitment, that's where you have an opportunity to try and fix a lot of the issues within not only a workplace, but within a structure, within a school system, within the education system.
One concern that critics of right-to-work legislation have had is that they worry that wages will be lower. Is that one of your concerns?
Absolutely. I think that, and as I was listening to the hearing last night, there was so many numbers being thrown out all over, and a lot of them were numbers from private studies. So I kind of disregarded all of that, and I looked specifically for numbers from our government. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that's the first thing that I listened to, actually had that statistic at right-to-work states had their earnings were about 3.2% less than regular states that didn't have right-to-work. So it was a concern. It's going to continue to be a concern, especially in a depressed economy like we have in Wisconsin.
Well, people who support the right-to-work bill say that it will make Wisconsin more competitive, bring in businesses that will in turn bring in jobs and give workers freedom to decide whether or not to pay dues. What do you think of that argument?
Well, let's look at the facts. Since Taft-Hartley, nobody has ever had to become a member of a union. There was a court case called it was with Beck. Beck actually, the ruling on Beck stated that anybody that was in the union, if they had problems with the political structure and the political support of the union, they did not have to contribute to that part of it. And Beck actually is in effect. I mean, I've had some of our members that have asked to be Beck objectors, and you have to honor that. So if that's a concern, if the political part is a concern, that's been taken care of. Nobody has to be a member, but in our state and under our guidelines and in our collective bargaining agreement, we do have to pay our fair share. It costs money. It needs support. Collective bargaining process needs support. Arbitration needs support. So the cost of representation in a facility is much larger than people realize, and that's for the best of all. It's for the best of all of our members.
And you're getting at this a little bit now, but how would you make the case that it's worth it to give up some of your earnings to pay union dues?
I think anybody that has been a member of a union, and I heard testimony of some people that were members that had a bad experience. Well, that's going to happen in any organization. But I think any member that has been part of a union and really realize the services that are offered for such a small amount of dues, a small amount of their income, would tell you that the representation that they get, the ability to collectively bargain a contract that not only has to do with their wages and their benefits, it has a lot to do with their work conditions, too. I would think that the majority of the people, and that's why all those people were up there this last week, is they have seen it firsthand, and they believe in what they've participated in. I know I have. I've been a member for 39 years, and I would not be without a union.
How do you think that the passage of this right-to-work bill could change your everyday life and also change things for your local United Auto Workers 180?
Well, here's my biggest concern. And a lot of people think that local unions take care of their own. And although it is true, our local union, and you can go way back in our charters and our constitution of the United Automobile Workers, our union is much more than just a labor union. It's a social union. We believe in justice on all levels. So if you want to take a look at, you know, some of the things that we've done, we're not only in the plant. We're all over. Think of some of the things that unions have been responsible for. We've been responsible for legislation. We've been responsible for contract wages, you know, paid vacations, paid holidays, retirement plans, health insurance within the workplace, overtime pay, sick leave, seniority rights, recall rights. We have some people out on layoff right now. The thing that they have is they have the ability to come back before any other hiring because they have recall rights. In my process here in Case, I've been laid off several times. Every time, my recall rights brought me back. They gave me the priority of coming back to work at my workplace. Look at arbitrations, grievances, safety standards. They've been involved in all of this. Within our community, what about public schools? Free textbooks, one man, one vote, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, minimum wages. All of that has come through the support of organized labor unions. Unions have pushed that. They've supported our working class people in our state and throughout the whole country.
And we leave it there. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, you have a good day.
That was Jeff Vash, president of the local UAW 180, which represents hourly paid employees at JIKCNH in Racine. We'll talk with a supporter of the right to work legislation Monday on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
We're focusing on the problem of military suicides in the United States. Since 2003, there have been more active duty suicides than battlefield deaths. On top of that, by some estimates, as many as 8,000 veterans are victims of suicide every year. That's almost one per hour.
John Bateson has tackled this problem in his new book, The Last and Greatest Battle, Finding the Will, Commitment, and Strategy to End Military Suicides. He's the former executive director of a nationally certified suicide prevention center in the San Francisco Bay Area. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, how bad are things? What is the scope of this problem?
Well, I mean, you just gave some statistics that demonstrate that the problem is significant, and it's certainly not lessening in any special way. The fact is that suicides have been a problem in the military going all the way back to the Civil War. There hasn't always been much data to support it other than anecdotal information. But the fact is that whether you're in a current war zone or one in past times, there's an awful lot of stress that goes with that, and that stress results in a lot of the problems that consequently trigger a suicide attempt. What we're seeing today, though, are the unique challenges of conflicts that take place nowadays, and they're having a particularly strong impact on suicide rates. The fact that we've got basically an asymmetrical battlefield, meaning that there's no front line, there's no rear line. Everywhere you are in a war zone, you're at risk, so there's no opportunity to relax, let down your guard. The need for constant vigilance and hyper-alertness is stressful and leads to sleep deprivation and reliance on medications. Then you've got the fact that the distinction between combatants and civilians is blurred. You've got women and children who are either used as shields or as suicide bombers. There's a changing role of the military, the fact that there are more urban peacekeeping responsibilities today, everything from running prisons to directing traffic. More than half the military people stationed in the Middle East now are reservists, National Guard members, and it's a very different experience for them. Many of them didn't join the reserves or guards in order to engage in conflict, and they don't have the same support system. They typically don't have as much training. You've got more women serving in the military nowadays, and certainly there have been a lot of stories recently about the prevalence of sexual assaults and how that's causing more female suicides in the military. And the bottom line, too, is the fact that the current war has just gone on far longer than any other war that the U.S. has engaged in, from the Civil War through the two world wars to Vietnam. So you've got all these stresses going on that are new and unique, and in many respects, the military is trying to deal with them. For a long time, there was some denial involved. But the fact is that, at least it's my belief, that the measures that are being taken are not nearly the ones that need to be implemented in order to make a significant difference.
And John, that's what I want to spend a little time on, some solutions, practical. And I want to start actually with a concept that I hadn't encountered before, a flip side of post-traumatic stress disorder, post-traumatic growth. What is that?
Basically, it's saying that through a negative circumstance, you can actually learn to see some positive elements in it. You can build up your resolve and restitution. Maybe you go into a village, and many times you're pelted with rocks or abused by the local villagers because some of their civilians have been killed. You know, other times they may be welcoming you with food and hospitality, and it kind of, the post-traumatic growth is the idea of seeing that even if you serve a really difficult period, maybe you're a POW or whatever. John McCain is famous for saying that, well, he wouldn't recommend being a POW to anybody. He feels that he grew out of the experience. And there was a former retired female general, Rhonda Cornum, who actually was one of the key players in implementing a whole program within the Army about teaching basically people to learn how to grow from having a negative experience such as serving in a combat zone.
And you mentioned you weren't happy with the current level of efforts. There are a lot of programs, you point out in your book, but there, none of them seem to be working together. There's no coordinated effort. What needs to change?
Well, there's a lot of things that need to be changed, and I think what the main thing is that the approach needs to be different. You know, typically in the military, the answer to most things is provide more training. We'll just provide more training, and people will be better informed. And the fact is that the problem of military suicides, especially today, goes far deeper than that, and it really requires significant changes in policies, procedures, attitudes, and culture. It doesn't involve simple things like telling soldiers that they need to or encouraging them to go seek help if they're feeling psychologically challenged in some way. And it doesn't mean providing more training. It doesn't mean just hiring more mental health professionals in the VA or the Department of Defense. It really means looking at making some deep-seated institutional changes in two very large bureaucracies in the United States. Where it really comes down to, and I'm recommend about 10 specific steps, but the first one is far and away the most important in my mind, and that is you have to go in with a commitment to end every single military suicide. Even one suicide is unacceptable if that person is your spouse, child, parent, sibling, close friend, partner. And so you've really got to adopt an attitude that we're going to solve every single suicide.
And one step I wanted to jump ahead to, John, following up on that, you say part of the way to get to that zero suicide goal is to assume that everyone coming out of active duty needs help. Why is that?
That's it. Assume that everybody who is coming out of active duty has experienced some kind of stress by virtue of their military service, and make sure that you are doing an appropriate assessment of them. And that assessment is not just a written questionnaire. It's much more involved than that. It means having one-on-one personal meetings with service members and also with their family members, the family members in confidential and separate settings. And ideally having those conversations for several years to take into account the fact that there may be some extenuating circumstances that continue long past someone's military service duty ending. So one thing is just to assume that everybody needs it, so you don't single out anybody for seeking it. That's very important. There's the fact that in the military today, and this is not the military's sole responsibility by any means, but mental illness and stigma carry an awful lot, or mental illness and suicide carry a lot of stigma in our society. And it's not the military's responsibility to end that in any way. But there are many things that the military can do. And again, these are deep-seated institutional changes that can really make a difference. And I highlight some of those in my book. The fact is that you can make a commitment to hire and promote individuals who have suffered and managed a traumatic injury, psychological injury, PTSD, and if they've been able to manage it, then they should be promoted, their stories should be told, they should be touted just the same way that a soldier who incurs a physical injury and is able to cope with it effectively becomes an inspiration for others.
John, thank you so much for being with us today. You can get more detail from John Bateson's new book, The Last and Greatest Battle, Finding the Will, Commitment, and Strategy to End Military Suicides. I've been talking with the author of that book, John Bateson, former executive director of a nationally certified suicide prevention center in the San Francisco Bay Area.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest takes a humble standby of American cooking and gives it an international spin.
The meatball is a staple of family dinners, buffet lines, and potlucks, and our guest tours the cuisines of the world to make it more fun. From Sweden to China, Italy to Ecuador, and from beef and pork to ostrich and even meatless, turns out there's a whole lot of meatballs out there.
Adeline Myers joins us now. She's a food writer and cooking instructor, and her new book is called Global Meatballs, Around the World in 100-plus boundary-breaking recipes. Adeline, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
So let's start with this focus. You're focusing exclusively on the humble meatball. Why?
Well, it's fun, for one thing. I've always loved meatballs, and I feel like whenever I tell someone that I wrote a book about meatballs, their first reaction is, oh, my goodness, I love meatballs. And there's, like, no matter where people are from, you know, we've got Americans and immigrants and people that are traveling, and anyone from any part of the world that I've talked to is like, oh, I love meatballs. And then they usually follow with this story about their favorite meatball or their mother's meatball or their father's meatball. And it's all very personal.
Well, you've got a lot of variety in the book, and we'll get into that. But are there some basic universal meatball tips that can help us with just about any recipe?
Yeah, you know, the structure of a meatball is simple, but there are some elements. I mean, I'm sure you've had that thing in the kitchen where your meatballs fall apart and you're like, oh, why did that happen,
yep.
Right? So the binder is usually an egg, and you can do them egg-free with things like flaxseed or bread, but the egg really holds them together. The proteins hold the meat or the beans or whatever sort of meatball you're making. That's what's going to keep it from falling apart. But you also don't want too much egg. So about for every pound of meat, you need one egg. And also for every pound of meat, it's usually about a teaspoon of salt. And that will make you a nicely flavored meatball. And then adding things like bread or breadcrumbs is really optional. So actually, half the book is gluten-free and not on purpose, just because much of the world doesn't eat bread the way that we do. And so that's quite interesting for people that are, you know, going that way.
If you don't want to use the breadcrumbs, what can you use instead as a filler?
Well, sometimes we use rice, or a lot of them have no fillers. And it's just a straight meat, and sometimes they are beans, or potato is a great one. I have this great lamb and potato kofta. They're from North India, and they have some spices in it, and the potato and the lamb just come together in this wonderful, like, texture that's just super satisfying and comforting.
One tip that I hadn't encountered before: when you roll the meatballs, have wet hands. Wet your hands before you do it. Why is that?
That is a super good tip. The meat will totally stick to your hands. You get like that dirty, sticky, meaty hands, and then the balls don't come out even or slick, and you'll get sort of a fuzzy texture. Yeah, it's not nice, and you're washing your hands all the time. But if you dip your hands in cold water or run them under a cold faucet, it will make the rolling easier and a lot more pleasurable in the kitchen.
Another thing that sometimes happens is the meatball kind of cracks or splinters. What's going on there?
You know, sometimes it's the balance of having too much egg or the outside cooking a lot faster than the inside. You know, I did a lot of testing, and sometimes that does happen. You know, the world is a funny place, and things are a little unpredictable. a lot of the fried ones will crack a little bit anyways. It just seems to be the way the gas escapes sometimes, but...
That's okay.
It's okay to have, you know, meatballs that aren't perfect. That's one of my messages.
So you have a suggestion I think would go over well here in Wisconsin. I've never tried it. Stuffing meatballs with cheese. How do we do that? What's the best way to get a cheese-stuffed meatball?
Oh, it's delicious. So you make your meatball mixture where you throw everything in the bowl and you mix it together with your hands. This is usually a key step. You know, it's really simple, kind of one bowl mixing. You got your eggs and your, you know, bread or potato and your spices and your meat or, you know, tofu, whatever you're working with. And you put a little of it in your hand and you sort of make a patty, almost like you're going to make a hamburger. Like you can roll it into a ball and flatten it into a patty. And then you stick... You just kind of stick your thumb in it and make a little divot and put your cheese in there and then roll it up around itself. And sometimes you have to put a little bit of more, you know, meat or potato or whatever you're working with on top. And then you roll it together in a ball and you've got your cheese stuffed meatballs. They're delicious.
It's hard to argue with cheese and anything, at least here in Wisconsin. But you also mentioned something else that caught my ear. You said tofu. I'm someone who eats mostly vegetarian, not completely. I just had a tuna melt for lunch. But let's say I don't want to have, you know, a ground beef, a lamb. I want to have something vegetarian. What options are there?
Well, a quarter of the book is vegetarian recipes. And a quarter is fish recipes. I know there's a lot of pescatarians, especially in my family. We have a lot of not meat eaters, and our holidays are ridiculous. You know, we've got a million options for everyone because someone's not eating something. So we're always trying to please a lot of different palates. So one of my favorites, you know, tofu's good, and there's a couple tofu recipes in here. I have a great one that is like a traditional Italian meatball with red sauce, but it's made with tofu and mushrooms, and it's amazing. People love it. But one of my favorites are these lentil balls, and you serve them with tahini sauce and pesto, and they're made with lentils, so they're full of protein and iron and all sorts of great vitamins, and really healthy for you.
Does it take more to make the veggie ones hold together? They might not adhere as well as the meat?
Yes. You know, testing out those tofu recipes was one of the harder things that I had to do in the book. They're less predictable. But the recipes are pretty straightforward, and, you know, sometimes I use potato starch, which is a familiar ingredient for a lot of people. It's a lot like cornstarch, but a little, I prefer it in meatballs. You know, some flour will help them hold together, and again, the eggs do the same thing.
Well, let's dig into a recipe, and we've shared this particular one over on the Central Time Facebook page. It's chorizo and white wine tapas meatballs. The name alone sounds kind of delicious, but what do you like about this one?
This is one of my favorite ones. It's actually the first recipe in the book, and I did that because I think it's one of the most approachable. I keep making it for parties and bringing it as appetizers, and they get gobbled up. So I encourage you to, like, try this one. It's actually National Meatball Day on Monday. So if you need an excuse to make meatballs ever, that would be it. So this one's really easy. You need leftover bread. So you take the crusts off a couple pieces of bread, which is a tradition in a lot of countries. Instead of breadcrumbs, they'll just use stale bread. And you soak that bread in white wine and that gives the meatballs a really interesting depth of flavor. It's a little unusual, but, you know, all the alcohol cooks off while you're cooking them. So they're not like boozy meatballs. It just has this great extra flavor. and then it involves ground pork, which you can get at your butcher or your grocery store, and chorizo uncooked sausage, which is also like a pork sausage, but it's really well flavored with paprika. And that takes a lot of the mixing, measuring, getting the flavor right element, you know, out of this. So it's simple. You get some sausage, you get your ground pork, you take the sausage out of the casing, and you're going to mix those together with the soaked white wine bread, and you add an egg and a little bit of garlic and parsley and a pinch of paprika and salt, and you roll it all together and bake them in the oven, which is, you know, a lot of people go for baking over frying because it is a little less fat. It's, you know, on the healthier side, and it's easy to. So you can throw like your 35 meatballs in the oven, and then you take them out and put the little toothpicks in them, and you're ready for a party. And it's easy, and they're delicious.
And what do you serve them with as far as a dip or things that go along with them?
You know, they're amazing by themselves. You could do a dip. I usually put olives next to them because the briny quality of the olives is really nice next to the sort of fatty, succulent meatballness. So something to counteract that, like pickles or some crunchy vegetables might be nice also. But no sauce in that case. And they're good, you know, warm or room temperature.
And I really like the meatballness.
Yeah.
We'll have to start using that as we discuss on our Food Fridays here.
We're talking to Adeline Myers, author of Global Meatballs Around the World in 100-plus Boundary-Breaking Recipes.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have a favorite meatball recipe? With meat, maybe without. Do you have a question for a guest about how to jazz up a recipe? You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Adeline Myers about her new cookbook, Global Meatballs, and she's sharing inspiration from around the world to jazz up an old classic.
And you can join in maybe with your recipes or with your questions on how to build a better meatball. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a recipe in your family, a favorite dish that you could tell us about? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our phones now. We've got Gary on the line in Rhinelander. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Yeah, you know, I think two foods or two groups that always makes anything better is bacon and cheese. So, and to me, a meatball is nothing more than meatloaf in a bite. And I'll make my meatloaf with like Cheetos or a different flavored type cracker that I have left over in the cupboard and such. So that works really well for us. So.
Yeah, that's pretty revolutionary. Cheetos in a meatball. I guess you get a little tangy, cheesy zip. What do you think about that suggestion, Adeline?
I like it, Gary. I think it's fun. You know, whatever brings more flavor into your meatballs is cool with me. I think every household does meatballs differently, and every country does them differently. But in the way, they're really all the same. They're kind of like people. We're all the same, but we're all really unique and different. And so I like your Cheez-It meatballs.
Well, speaking of every country having their own, a lot of Scandinavian influence here in Wisconsin, what is your favorite take on the famous Swedish meatball?
Well, I love the Swedish meatball, and I was testing recipes and had some wonderful people trying them, and they said, oh, you've forgot the nutmeg, and I was like, oh, okay, forgot the nutmeg. We put it in, it was amazing. And the Swedish meatball is great. It's a little sweet and sour and traditional and really beloved. Another one, if you're into Scandinavian food, you should really try the fiskabollen, which is I don't know if that's very popular out there, but it's a fish ball made with pureed white fish, and then it's really lightly poached in just barely simmering water, and it's just phenomenal. I was floored when I tried them for the first time, because I'd heard about them, and I have a family member who came a long time ago from Sweden, and she loves them, but I'd never had them, and those were a surprisingly delicious, like they came out of that hot water, and I was like, wow, I see why everyone is in love with these things. They're served with a white sauce, like a traditional white sauce, but if you don't do dairy, you can use, you can make like little curry sauce for them. And that's becoming more and more popular in Sweden right now.
I'll say opinion is divided among Central Time hosts on the fish meatball concept. I've had them in like Chinese restaurants. I really like the idea. Veronica, you're not, you're not so enthralled with the notion.
You ratted me out. No, I don't know. I'm agnostic. Maybe this will be the one to convert
Veronica,
me to the fish meatball.
It's fair enough. And, you know, they're unusual to make. If you know, your listeners have never made fish balls before, the first time you grind up that fish, you're thinking, what am I doing? Shouldn't I just be, you know, broiling this or frying this? Why am I turning this into a paste? I do it every time. I catch my breath. But they're awesome. They're really tender. And I keep telling people, if you have someone in your family who doesn't like fish, which, you know, I think a lot of children are like that. They maybe wouldn't mind the taste because it's so very mild. But if you, you know, if they don't like the texture of that flaky fish, if it creeps them out, make fish balls and they'll eat them. Children love meatballs and they love fish balls. There's something great about letting them hold the food. It's like handheld food. It's edible. And the fish balls, they like lose the whole texture of the fish and take on this amazing dumpling quality, and there isn't much flavor there. So it's a great vehicle for sauces and things, and they're really healthy. Most of them are poached. Some are fried, and they're amazing. They're like fried fish. So, Veronica, I respect that you don't, you know, you're not on the bandwagon.
Thank you for your open mind.
I have to say. But for those of you out there who are wondering, like, maybe that sounds good, they're totally worth trying.
Well, I think Rob will make a batch over the weekend, yes, and then you can bring
make them all myself.
Well, then you're not making
Rob,
any converts.
Rob, let me know how they, let me know how you like them.
Yes.
And any of you, you know, people out there trying meatballs on National Meatball Day, you should, like, send out a hashtag Global Meatballs on Twitter. And with your pictures, I would love to see what people are making.
And we've got Jackie with us next in Brown Deer. Jackie, hi.
Hi, my suggestion is for a meatless meatball is take a nut loaf recipe, which usually is used for kind of a meatloaf substitute, but then you could also use it for meatballs, which I've done, and then use like a Swedish meatball gravy to go with it or something like that, or dip it in a cheese sauce or something like that.
That sounds super delicious. Thanks for that idea, Jackie. And what about, you know, using a nut loaf to make a meatball?
You know, same thing. It's nut loafs, meatloafs, meatballs. They're all sort of the same concept. You have these small minced ingredients put together in an attractive, edible form. So it's a great, you know, easy step to make meatless meatballs in your kitchen. I say go with a nut loaf. And if you're a more like from scratch cook, a couple of the recipes in the book are basically like that. We have, you know, you put the ingredients together yourself. But you got vegetables and nuts. There's an amazing one that's one of my favorites to make in the summer. It's called Ruby Beet Balls, and that's like shredded red beets and walnuts and some onion and a couple other things. But that's all rolled in together. And that's a recipe from Georgia, the country, not our state. And that's an amazing one. That's a lot like, has the nutty elements of a nut loaf, but also the fresh qualities of vegetables.
That sounds really good. You know, for cooking with meat ones, one question I wanted to get to before we're done, how do we know when they're done? Like, I'm super paranoid cooking with ground meat, and I always like end up bisecting, you know, about a third of them. That one's done. That's big. That one's done. Is there a way to check them without cutting into most of them?
I hear you there. That is a huge question that we all ask. A good meat thermometer is something handy to have in your kitchen, and you can check the temperatures that, you know, ground beef and ground pork should be at. Some of us like to go a little bit more rare with some of our cuts of meat, and they're saying with pork, you don't have to be as careful as we used to have to be. So, you know, buy it from good sources and cook it well. I honestly do often end up cutting one in half because sometimes I just want to check that my thermometer is saying the right thing. But there's also a thing you can do with your hand. Have you ever heard this, where you put your finger, let's see, your first finger and your thumb together, and you push on that part of your, that sort of soft part of your thumb by your palm, and that's what rare meat tastes like. And then if you, or feels like, you can learn how to feel the meatballs. I'm not explaining this very well, but you can totally go on YouTube and look it up. And if you put your thumb on one finger in turn and press that soft part of your thumb, that's how you can tell. You guys should just go on YouTube and look that up.
That sounds like a visual, definitely.
It's a visual. I'm doing it here, but you can't see it on the radio.
All right. Adeline, thank you so much. And on Monday, happy Meatball Day to you.
Thank you. Happy Meatball Day to you.
We've been talking to Adeline Myers about her new book, Global Meatballs. We have a recipe of hers, chorizo and white wine tapas meatballs, on the Central Time Facebook page. And our producer, Chris Molina, just tweeted that as well. So check it out.
I think that's the first time Happy Meatball Day has been said on Central Time.
I think that's true. We'll have to consult the archives.
Many firsts.
Yeah. The Washington Post has a new report that gives us the word on the street, literally. A writer crunched the numbers to find out the most common road names around the United States and broke it down by state.
And the number one most common road naming in the United States and Wisconsin is Park. Park Street. There are over 9,000 Park Streets, roads, and avenues in the country. Over 300 of them are right here in Wisconsin, and one of them just outside the lobby window by our studio, by the way.
Nationwide, second place goes to Second. Yeah, there are more Second Streets than First Streets in the country. Possibly, they say, because First Street is often replaced by Main Street in a lot of states.
And here in Wisconsin, we love our trees. We've got maple, pine, oak, and those come in second through fourth, followed by river and lake.
We're going to go out to the news here on Central Time with you two and a place that would have been left out of these numbers.
Streets Have No Name by U2. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. Then we'll discuss updates on Right to Work and other major headlines from around the state in our news roundup. You're listening to Central Time.